This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on August 11th. The Texas Tribune reports that in June, Governor Greg Abbott signed into law HB 3979. The law restricts how U.S. history and current events can be taught in Texas schools. It's often called the Critical Race Theory Bill, even though the term critical race theory is not found anywhere in it. In signing the bill, Governor Abbott noted that critical race theory must be abolished in Texas. In addition, he announced that he would ask the legislature to address the issue further during a special session. The Texas legislation reflects a noisy debate throughout the country. About a year ago, Christopher Rufo, senior fellow for the conservative Manhattan Institute, began to use the term critical race theory in an attempt to denounce anti-racist education efforts. Since that time, use of the term has snowballed. Alarmed conservatives claim that CRT is the basis for teaching children that they are racist and that the U.S. is a racist country with tarnished roots. Senator Ted Cruz and others have labeled CRT itself racist since it emphasizes the role of racial conflict in U.S. history. Monica Martinez, member of the UT history faculty, notes that the current curriculum already teaches that one race is superior. She observes, "Look at how it teaches the history of the Texas Revolution, that people like Stephen F. Austin are racially superior to the treacherous Mexicans like Santa Anna. Texas history has been taught in a way that celebrates people who were fighting for the institution of slavery, that were espousing publicly that Mexicans were an inferior race." The Texas Tribune concludes that some teachers fear that the law may have a chilling effect on efforts to nurture critical thinking, which promotes inclusion of multiple perspectives on historical events to illustrate how the past has impacted current issues. They quote Andrew Robinson, an eighth grade history teacher in Dallas. "What they're trying to say with this is that the actions of the past aren't affecting the present. They want us to act like slavery and Jim Crow have no bearing on the issues in our society right now. And if that's the case, then they should cancel my class." Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is David DeMatthews, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy at UT Austin. Last month, he wrote an opinion piece for the Austin American Statesman titled "SB 3 Seeks to Rewrite History. That Should Concern All Texans." We also have regular guest Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Tech Civil Rights Project. And Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of this program, joins us as well. David, how are you doing?
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us. Let's start off with just a little about your background. Tell us how you got to UT here and what you teach and your research areas.
Sure. So I actually started my career in education as a social studies teacher, an American government teacher in Baltimore. So I got my initial interest in history as an undergraduate, and then I went into teaching because I was passionate about history. I worked as a school administrator. I worked as a district administrator in Baltimore City and the District of Columbia Public Schools. And then after receiving my PhD in education, I became a professor at UTEP first, University of Texas at El Paso, which is on the border. And that exposed me to a different community than I was used to working in. And now for the last 3 years, I've been at UT Austin, working in the Department of Educational Leadership, where we primarily prepare aspiring principals, aspiring superintendents, and also researchers who would work for think tanks or work for a state department of education.
Well, I don't even know where to begin with all this, but the topic is revisionism in U.S. history. And this is not my area. I'm actually an engineer by training. But in recent years, I've become much more aware of what's been left out of U.S. history, had just a slight exposure to Howard Zinn and some others. Maybe you could lead off, David, just talking a little about revisionism and how is it that we're more aware of all this right now in history?
Sure. So I think a lot of attention now is coming the way in which textbooks and curriculum are designed and who they privilege, I think especially with social movements and with social media. I'm 39, I'm not that old, but even the history that I grew up with in high school, it really privileged one primary perspective of, say, American government or American history, and it didn't really tell you some of the counter stories or narratives. And for me, it wasn't really till I went to public university where I started to learn more about history from different perspectives. And I think that was really eye-opening for me. And I began to question in my 20s, well, why is it that you have to get to college to, say, learn more about civil rights movement or the Chicano movement or women's suffrage? How come that is not embedded in the curriculum in elementary, middle, and high school? So that was something that I think has been concerning. And so there's researchers that have focused very specifically curriculum and how it's developed and who it privileges. My research and my role has really focused on the role that school leaders can play in supporting teachers in adapting, creating inclusive and culturally responsive learning environments. So I think it's been an issue for a long time in this country where there's been revisionist history, partly based on who's been writing it. But now I think there's an opportunity because it's easy to get teachers new resources. There are different movements and activists that are championing different perspectives. And I think there's also a desire among students of all ages to learn more about the diverse perspectives of people and the founding of this country and also the future direction, what the history tells us about where we might be going.
But here in the state of Texas, I mean, there are plenty of people who would probably label that subversive.
Yeah, there very well could be. And some of that may be attached to their prior experiences and what they've learned in their Texas history class or in their U.S. history classes. Or maybe it's tied to some facet of their identity that they view as under attack right now. But I really think if we could step into a bubble for a minute and away from social media and cable news, and we just talked about the history that's been pretty well documented, I think we could probably get past a lot of the comments of calling each other subversives or racists or, you know, whatever the attack of the moment might be.
Jim, you know, you as founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, surely you must have seen a lot of this as well in your work.
Yeah, we did. I mean, we did have some cases against universities, for example, students whose rights were infringed upon. But, you know, I think it was interesting working in the Valley for 10 years because I heard a lot of this stuff orally from people, the history of Texas that was different than what's in the textbooks. And so I think I've been sort of attuned to that for a while. And of course, you have the quintessential fake fact of the Alamo, the way the kids are taught about that and in reality, what's going on. You know, I did a book on the Texas Bill of Rights, its origins and so on. But the thing that struck me in that this is not part of our history that we're taught either is that when we redid the Constitution after the Civil War, you know, there were progressive parts of it and progressive parts that did not find their ways into the other Southern constitutions. And there was an alliance made between poor whites and blacks and Mexicans against the monopolies and the railroads and the banks. And they had power. So what happened then is that 90% of the black community voted at that time. It's pretty amazing. The only way that the establishment could deal with it was introducing the Klan, the rule of terror in Texas. And all that stuff is not taught, you know, and I think it's so important. And the history of the Texas Rangers, of course, you know, there were like 4,000 people in Texas, black and Hispanic, that were lynched or shot in the back, as was typically the case of the Texas Rangers. But I think it's really important, you know, and I really appreciate having read that article, because it gets this stuff out into public. It gets that discussion going. It helps us understand our state and where we are right now. That's a long answer to a short question.
It's okay. So David, Jim cites the Texas Rangers, and I think a number of us have read about, I think it was one massacre in particular that was fairly horrific. Can you cite some other specific examples of things that are only now really becoming more commonly known than they were certainly in U.S. history textbooks that most of us learned from?
Well, I mean, I think one thing recently that's kind of come into the spotlight, and I've even had some students of mine who are teachers and assistant principals ask, is the book Forget the Alamo, and kind of speaking more to a factual account of the Battle of the Alamo and the individuals who were involved and the contributions of Tejano. So I think that's probably one of the biggest ones right now. And since it got a lot of fanfare and attention with all that's gone on in the past month or so, I think that's one particular area teachers right now are going to be more interested in. If, of course, some of the legislation and proposed legislation doesn't cool teachers' desires to take on some of these issues.
Right. Well, speaking of which, you know, I'm trying to sort out the legislation. I think the bill that was actually signed into law was HB 3979. Could you tell us what that's about?
Sure. So kind of an interesting phenomenon happened across the country. A lot of these kind of bills were labeled as like anti-critical race theory bills. HB 3979 didn't speak specifically to critical race theory, which is, you know, something we could talk about. But really what that bill included was some language around the fact that teachers cannot be compelled to discuss a particular current event or an event or an issue that is somehow viewed as widely debated or currently controversial. And that was kind of the main part of that legislation that I think stood out for a lot of teachers, a lot of principals, a lot of superintendents. What exactly does this mean? How does this translate? And will this have an effect on teachers? Will teachers be afraid, for example, to talk about the George Floyd case, or the next time there is a national awakening around a certain civil rights or social justice issue?
David, I'm really curious about what your sense is that where teachers are on this. I mean, is there like a substantial group, do you think, that will work around this? If so, how extensive would you think that would be?
Based on my experience, I think it is going to have a kind of a chilling effect on teachers. I do think there are certainly teachers who are critically engaged, who are excited to talk about current events and controversial issues in class, and they see that as their role, especially as a social studies teacher. When I did my master's at Johns Hopkins, that was something that we talked about, like that you have a role as a social studies teacher to engage with students in meaningful ways. But unfortunately, with so much emphasis placed on standardized tests, especially, you know, with 3 school years of disruption caused by the pandemic, I think principals and teachers are under immense pressure to perform on assessments. And so I think, first of all, too many teachers and principals' priorities are on just achieving those test scores, and not enough priorities are on, you know, making sure students are critically engaged on a variety of issues. So I think that's probably the biggest obstacle. And then I think we're not preparing teachers to teach in these types of ways, and teachers don't have the time and access to information to inform themselves, then it's going to be really difficult for a large group of teachers to engage in this work. And I do know that some teachers who are current or former students are a little bit afraid to broach certain issues because of the way they deem their administration or the things they've heard about the legislation in the media that may not be true, but just the myth of what the bill actually says, I think can constrain them from taking on some of these issues.
What do you know of that's out there to educate teachers and administrators, especially here in Texas, about being able to work around the law that's now on the books? I've also heard that there are protections. Obviously, the teachers that belong to unions will have protections, you know, if they go against what the law is at the time. And as you also said, that there's a lot of leeway in how the law itself is interpreted. So I'm just curious what's going on as far as informing teachers and administrators about this.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's part of why I wanted to write the op-ed, is to also kind of clarify what's going on. And I wrote one similar on HB 3979. Hopefully, both teachers, school districts, their professional organizations provide them with updates on legislation, because HB 3979 doesn't stop them from teaching about racism, doesn't kind of include some of the maybe more problematic aspects that the proposed SB 3 had in it. It really just noted that teachers couldn't be compelled to discuss these types of current events or so-called controversial public policy issues. And so if they were compelled personally, if they wanted to, if their students were asking them about these issues and they wanted to take them on, then I think they can. And hopefully both their administration, the school district itself, and then also their professional associations within the state and the teachers' unions are informing them that they do have these rights. And there's other things in the Texas Education Code where, you know, teachers have a degree of autonomy in making decisions about the content they teach. They have to, of course, follow standards, but the standards are not so prescribed that teachers can't pull in certain texts, certain primary source documents, or kind of develop units and themes, lessons that explore some of these issues.
If we could just wind back a little bit here, we sort of glossed over critical race theory, or CRT, it's often seen in the media. That's getting a lot of play in the press, and I suspect especially in the Fox News end of the spectrum. Could you define that for our listeners? Does that really play into HB 3979 and the efforts of social study teachers, for example?
One thing, I started in education in 2005, a master's and a PhD in education. And actually, through my training to prepare to be a teacher, to prepare to be an administrator, getting my PhD, I'd actually never heard of critical race theory. I never read an article or a book on critical race theory through all of my undergraduate and graduate preparation. It wasn't really until I became a professor that I was exposed to the theory. So I do find it shocking that it's being presented as something that is pervasive in society, when for somebody who's worked in education in different states at different universities, didn't really come to know it until becoming a professor. The other thing that I think is really interesting about CRT is I think actually if most people knew what CRT was, they'd probably agree with it without even knowing. So there's a few facets or tenets to CRT, but I guess maybe starting with it, it's a theory that comes out of the field of law. And some of those tenets include that race is a social construction, that racism is a normal feature of society and it's embedded within systems and institutions. And so it's not just a few bad apples who are racist, but there are unseen forces, kind of the ways in which things have been done that are more systemic. And then importantly, I mean, this really connects to the conversation that we're having. CRT calls for a recognition of the everyday lives and lived experiences of people of color, which in history has often been excluded. So I think if you talk to most people who say they're anti-CRT and you approach the conversation a little differently and you ask them some of these questions about CRT or talked about it, I think a lot of people would agree with it. I think the way the media and some politicians have presented it they've done so in a way that, first of all, doesn't represent what CRT is. And second, it really is alarming people and making them afraid that schools are somehow teaching white children to hate themselves or their histories or their ancestors, which is entirely not the case.
Well, it's certainly become a rallying point for the far right. It seems to be inspiring a great deal of fear. I was reading about something called the 1836 Project here in Texas, which apparently is a state effort to bolster tourism and to feature the sites in the history of Texas, you know, the Alamo being the crown jewel, as it were. The name, the 1836 Project, stands in contrast to the 1619 Project, which was a series of articles that the New York Times ran about the 500th anniversary of Jamestown. What do you think is going on here? With everything so polarized, how do we cut through this?
Yeah, the politics of this are pretty tricky, but I mean, it seems like a pretty thinly veiled attempt to whitewash history and maybe rally a political base that doesn't maybe fully recognize what 1836 might mean to other people. So again, kind of going back to CRT, that recognizing the lived experiences of other people, for some, 1836 doesn't necessarily connect entirely to the independence. It also connects to slavery and exploitation for people of color.
The new book on the Alamo, I just want to ask you what you think about it.
Well, I'm definitely not an expert on Texas history, but I enjoyed reading it, first of all, and I think it covered a lot of important ground. And what I really appreciated about the book, so first they provide a historical account of the Battle of the Alamo, some of the antecedents to the battle, and some of what happened after. And then they kind of talk about the historiography of the battle. So how the writing about the Battle of the Alamo evolved over time. I think that's really important for teachers to see, because I think as teachers, a lot of times we push our students to be a little bit skeptical of what you read in the textbooks and instead, you know, encourage them to think for themselves and to be critical readers and to look for other sources of information and other facts, look at primary source documents. And so I think it's really interesting that the Forget the Alamo book talks about the way the history developed and how that history was really focused on the experiences of a particular group, was really rooted in a great deal of racism towards Tejanos, towards Mexico, the framing of different characters in the story. And then I think even the book goes a bit further in talking about kind of the current political context and how the history of the Alamo has always kind of been somewhat contested by different groups. So, I mean, I think it's a great history book in and of itself, because for students who read it or for teachers who read it, it's really a case study of a historical event that you could then ask yourself a different question or look at a different topic in history and consider, well, is what's in our textbook about the experiences of Native Americans? Can we draw parallels to the way the Battle of the Alamo or the Texas Revolt has been framed in our textbook? So I think it's a fantastic book.
Well, it certainly got under Dan Patrick's skin.
That it did. What is most interesting, the summers are pretty busy for me, kind of reading and preparing and writing. And because of it getting under Dan Patrick's skin, it popped up on my news feed. And I was like, oh, well, if the book is drawing that much controversy, let me prioritize some time and read it. I have to admit, I might not have read it or read it as quickly if it wasn't for Dan Patrick's comments. Actually appreciative that he called it out.
Let me ask you another question, David, and that's about the anti-intellectual thing that goes on in our country. Are we about the same level, or are we in a different level these days?
I don't know, but I will say, so I try to write op-eds that explain what I think are important issues in public education. And I feel like that's my role as a researcher and somebody who was a teacher and administrator and now kind of working in higher education. Sometimes I get really nasty comments from people from all varying positions, but usually I get emails from people who disagree with what I write, but do so in respectful ways, or at least in ways that I think they're trying to be respectful. And I have some hope there. I do think there's just so much, I don't know that it's anti-intellectual. I think there's so much bombardment in the media and so much polarization in our society that when you write about something or talk about something that uses one of those buzzwords, people just automatically jump or snap. And then we all kind of look at the most extreme responses. I think most Texans would want to know the true story of the Battle of the Alamo. It's just kind of removing all of that noise that exists out there. And I think most teachers would want to teach that and make sure they actually have adequate facts and resources to teach and then go ahead and do that work.
Speaking of your op-ed, you reference SB3, and could you provide maybe a contrast between HB 3979, which was signed into law, and SB3, which I guess is still hanging out there, and Abbott is promoting this on the agenda of the special sessions. Is that right?
Again, HB 3979 was really about ensuring that teachers can't be compelled to discuss certain current events and controversial issues or so-called controversial issues. It didn't really try to remove key aspects of the curriculum. Now, SB3 that was proposed during the first special session, it removed a lot of things that would typically be covered in the curriculum. So it stripped out requirements that include Native American history, the work of Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, documents that students would read, so primary source documents students would read related to the Chicano movement and women's suffrage, from Martin Luther King, so removing the letter from a Birmingham jail, writings of Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony. It also removed requirements to teach about the eugenics movement and the KKK. And so just by removing these requirements, it doesn't mean that teachers couldn't still teach about them, but those were no longer requirements. And it just seems so strikingly odd and problematic that with all that's going on right now in our society and within our state, that we would have legislation proposed that would remove critical parts of our history and information that students really need to understand the society in which they live.
Our guest this evening is David DeMatthews, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy at UT Austin. We're discussing SB3 and critical race theory. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on August 11th. Our guest this evening is David DeMatthews, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy at UT Austin. We're discussing SB3 and critical race theory. Let's pick up where we left off.
What institutions like UT, for example, are doing to kind of prepare the next wave of educators on the topics of history and even the whole movement towards anti-racism teaching, I think, in general, so that affects every subject that's taught in schools these days. I think I'm the only one here that actually took Texas history because I went to school in Texas. And I know that the teachings on Texas history have improved somewhat since I was a child. I have a teacher in my family now. My oldest daughter is a teacher, but she's a science teacher and she went to UT. So I'm just curious how things, especially in the last couple of years with all this talk going on, how is the university itself addressing this and making sure that the teachers are being prepared for this onslaught that they're facing and still being able to teach what needs to be taught?
SB3, you know, has not been passed. And again, I think as Bob mentioned, the governor has encouraged in the upcoming special session, if it actually happens, that they look at SB3 again, the proposed SB3. But I think most universities, including UT, there are both national standards for preparing teachers and also standards around preparing social studies teachers or science teachers or math teachers. And then in states like Texas, which like to have kind of its own set of standards, there's also kind of certain expectations, and every institution in the state adheres to those expectations. And those standards don't include some of this type of stuff in the first place. So kind of whitewashing history. But I think at UT or at any institution, especially for social studies teachers, teachers who might be teaching Texas history or American history, it's really important. And there's an emphasis typically that they have strong content knowledge, that they understand history from diverse perspectives. And so I do think at most universities, they may not be getting a course specifically on critical race theory. They're likely not getting any course on critical race theory, but I do think they're reading a broad selection of books and materials. Professors are providing lectures with greater diversity of information, and hopefully they're able to pull that into the classroom. And then I think, you know, depending on departments, when you look across Texas universities or across the country, the faculty's perspectives do help to shape the way the curriculum and programs are developed. And I think that that is important too. So we really care about ensuring that teachers and principals teach in ways that promote equity and are culturally responsive. And so I think that's a shift you're seeing across the country as well.
Thinking about the Texas legislature and its efforts to revise history, I'm reminded of just three sessions ago, 2015, when there was at least talk about referring to enslaved people as immigrant workers. I'm just curious, did that ever make it into law?
I'm not entirely sure. I need to look back, but I do know we've had some issues with adopted textbooks in the past. And I do think we had adopted a textbook from one of the big publishers that used a select term like immigrant worker or something to describe slaves. And, you know, the publisher apologized, but I think it was something that really stands out as glaring and problematic that a history textbook in the United States would actually make that type of mistake or decide to make that immigrant workers and placed enslaved people.
Yeah, there was a whole history of the Texas legislature over the last 10, 20 years, particularly around themes of evolution, for example, and religion, that I don't recall the specifics either, but I just shake my head, as I'm sure you and many of your colleagues do too. Thinking of broader terms here, back to the theme about extremes and this whole thing becoming a battleground, I always try to make sense out of what's going on in current events, you know, which quickly these days roll themselves into history. I think about the election of Barack Obama in 2008, followed by the election of Donald Trump, and then just a year ago, Black Lives Matter. Do you have any sense as an historian about weaving these into a thread and what caused what and where we're headed at this point? I mean, do you have a crystal ball?
I don't. I'm thinking maybe Jim does.
Don't we wish? David, I was listening to your comments. This legislation, what it really does is it protects those teachers, let me say East Texas, for example, that don't want to face reality or have their students face reality. And actually, that seems to me to be pretty dangerous because they can weave their curriculum the way they want to weave it. And if somebody says an administration, you should do this, then they can point to that law as a way of ducking their responsibilities. Actually, I see that to be a lot more pernicious in that way than I think I had contemplated in the beginning.
That's a good point, Jim. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but yeah, that upholds the white supremacist ideology that's out there, doesn't it, in a kind of insidious way.
There can be a great deal of groupthink, right? So I think oftentimes administrators get viewed as bullies of teachers. And, you know, sometimes that was the case. I've been on kind of both sides of that. But administrators were also teachers and often in those same communities. And so you're often talking about the same people. So it could be a way for a school entirely to avoid having those types of conversations. And when families show up at school board meetings, the district and the schools themselves can kind of absolve themselves from talking about those particular issues, which can be pretty problematic. But the one thing I've learned as a teacher and also as a school administrator is it's hard to legislate what a teacher does. Even as a principal, it's hard to legislate what a teacher does because, you know, you have 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 classrooms in a school all going on and one or two administrators. Teachers know that, whether it's teaching about race or the Battle of the Alamo, or if it's just turning on the TV and letting students kind of do whatever they want. Teachers know they have autonomy in the classroom. And so they're kind of viewed as these street level bureaucrats that are the final policymakers and decision makers of any policy. And I think good principals and teachers are going to still teach about these things. And I'm sure even in East Texas, there are pockets where educators are really trying to connect students with this information. And then I'm sure there's other pockets where, regardless of what the curriculum says, they're going to teach a whitewashed version. And I think the best that we can hope for is that we continue to try to push educators in their preparation and their professional development. We show up at school board meetings and we push superintendents to prioritize teaching a history that is informative and tells the truth about our history for better and for worse.
You've just provided some really great concluding thoughts there.
Well, I know you asked about from the first Black president with Barack Obama and then Donald Trump and Black Lives Matter, and then also what we saw happen on January 6th. I do think we're very polarized time. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And now we have policymakers that are dipping their toes into what kind of what's happening in curriculum in very problematic ways. And to me, I'm still hopeful though. All of this tells me that what teachers do really matters. At least for me personally, being someone who works with teachers every day and works with principals and superintendents, I'm excited to get up. I'm hopeful because I know there are good people working in our schools that really want the best for students, and that regardless of the policies and challenges that exist for teachers, they're going to find ways to do what's right for kids. And the more we can draw attention to these problematic policies and get voters concerned about these problematic policies, the easier the jobs will be for teachers and principals. But I still think the majority of them are going to do what they think is best for kids. And I'm still optimistic, even in some kind of difficult times right now.
Jim, anything else you wanted to add?
I have two kids that are teachers, you know, so I have enormous, enormous respect for teachers. I'm not so sanguine that all teachers are trying to do their best for the kids. That's the problem. And I think that we see a lot of teachers who will use these laws as a reason not to get educated, to continue to sort of slough off their responsibilities. And you're right. I mean, of course, it's not just East Texas. I mean, you can go anywhere. This is just part of this movement to be fact adverse. I've referred to it as anti-intellectual earlier. We see that all the facts are being driven by people's politics. And that lack of critical thinking, I think, is really problematic. And I don't see it happening as well and or as much as it ought to be in school, and particularly in high schools.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. I have a positive outlook, I think maybe in part because I have to do this work every day. And I think you're right. A lot of people's facts are driven by politics, but I still do think that there is a positive trajectory among teachers and how they're prepared and supported and the information they have access to. From when I started teaching in 2005 to today. But I also agree with you that teachers can be very insulated, set in their ways. And despite all the progress in terms of developing curricular materials and preparation programs that focus more on equity and provide facts that maybe they didn't 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, that some people can still be pretty recalcitrant. So I see that too, but I'm still hopeful that over time we'll look back at some of these issues and we'll probably still be fighting over something, but hopefully we'll have moved the needle a little bit.
Well, I can tell you, as one who tutors math these days, I have an even greater appreciation for how much easier my job is than social studies teachers.
Thanks for all your good work, David. Thanks for everything you're doing. It's really good.
Thank you. And thanks for all the work that you've done.
Yeah, we really appreciate having you on. This has been in the news quite a bit lately, and it's wonderful to have an outspoken leader like yourself clarifying the issues here and enlightening us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
The following segment was originally scheduled to air last week, but did not due to technical difficulties.
Good evening again. This is Michelle Manning Scott, co-hosting the program along with Bob Daly. It's Friday, August the 6th, 2021, as we record this conversation. Bob and I are being joined by Christina Puentes and Luis Gonzalez, the chair and vice chair, respectively, of the City of Austin's Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission, or ICRC. The City of Austin has a process for residents to redraw the boundaries of the council districts every 10 years, and 2021 is once again time to do it. The boundaries of the council districts greatly impact Austin's government and will shape how residents are represented for the next decade. So welcome, Christina and Luis.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Yeah, so let's start by the two of you giving us a brief background on the history of the formation of this committee. For example, there are 14 members selected to be on the commission. So let's start there.
So you are correct. The Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission for the City of Austin is made up of 14 commissioners. Those commissioners are not selected by any politician, and we do not have any connections to anyone who works at the city. And that was a minimum requirement of applying for the job in the first place. We are volunteers. We are all public servants. We're residents of Austin who care about the redistricting process and how it is managed. Some of us have full-time jobs. We have a student commissioner on our body, and others have families to care for. We're doing this work with other commitments and not being paid 1 cent for any of the work that we're doing. So a little bit about the selection process is that the City of Austin, the auditor's office, received over 300 applications for placement on the ICRC this time around. Over 89% of those 300 applications met those minimum requirements and were identified as not having any conflicts of interest. An applicant review panel of three CPAs then selected the 60 most qualified applicants. And through a random drawing system, 8 commissioners were selected from those 60. Those 8 commissioners then had a really difficult task, and I was one of those first 8. We had a very difficult task in then choosing the 6 additional applicants from that qualified pool. The 8 commissioners really wanted the full commission to reflect the diversity of Austin. So while the primary decision-making was for all districts to be represented, racial, ethnic, gender, and age diversity also played a role in our decision process. So we have 14 commissioners. And as I mentioned, those members are very diverse. What makes us the same, though, is that each one of us calls Austin home. This term is for 10 years, and it prevents any of the current members from serving or running for local office for that same amount of time, because, of course, we're drawing the boundaries that we could potentially run in the future. So it protects us from any conflicts of interest. And lastly, we had to be a resident and have voted in city elections for the last 5 years before applying for the ICRC.
That's very informative. There are 10 districts in Austin, but there are 14 of you. Christina, you're representing District 7, and Luis, you're representing District 10. How is it that the districts were chosen to get more than one representative? Is that just by chance?
It really was by chance. So when we were identifying the 6 additional commissioners, we definitely wanted to make sure that the districts that were not represented in those first 8 were represented in the additional 6. And then it was really about qualifications and reading those applications and learning about the individual through written comments that they submitted. As long as we had one in each district, we felt covered. And then we went a little bit deeper to be like, what skills, what expertise, what lived experience could those additional commissioners provide to the 8 that were already selected?
And Christina, were you in the initial round or were you one of the 6 chosen later?
I was actually one of the 6 chosen. And I was chosen as a student applicant because I'm currently working on my master's degree at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. But I ended up not being the student commissioner in the end, because we have another one, Shana Cambo, who is an undergraduate at the University of Texas right now.
That is correct. The 8 commissioners accidentally chose 2 student commissioners. We learned through the charter process that we were only to have 1. So thankfully, Christina was also, not only did she qualify as a student applicant, she qualified as a quote-unquote normal commissioner for placement on the ICRC.
How did the chair and the vice chair positions get chosen?
It came up for a vote in one of our Wednesday meetings. We meet every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for our general meetings. And after the 14 commissioners were selected, it was time to nominate a chair and a vice chair. So some names were thrown around. Christina showed an immense and immediate passion and expertise for redistricting. And myself and a few other commissioners decided to nominate her for the chair position. And then she graciously accepted. And somehow I was nominated as the vice chair position, which I'm hoping that it was because of my administrative and kind of organizational background in my career.
So we've currently got boundaries for the 10 districts. Are you starting with that and then just tweaking those? Or are you starting all over again? What's this work look like?
It's really up to us what we end up doing with the 10 districts. We have heard testimony from the public in both directions that you've described, Bob. We could take the 10 city council districts as they are and revise them to match the changing diversity and geographic changes around the city, or we could scrap that and start over. And while we are completely free of any political ties to the city, there are absolutely political implications either way.
And I will add here, just the first iteration of the commission in 2013, they used census data from 2010 to really draw those boundaries and did the best to ensure that the top priority, that each district has a reasonable equal population. And at that time, it was 79,000 individuals for each district. They did everything possible to ensure that priority was met. But given the rapid growth in Austin, I believe now we're over 1 million residents in Austin. We will use census data from 2020 that shows that our population is somewhere near 995,000. So each district now would be approximately 99,500 individuals. That's like almost 20,000 increase for each district. So of course, these boundaries will change.
When did you officially start your meetings to start the process? How long are you given to do this? And then what does this process look like? How do you go about doing this?
I will take this only because I mentioned that I was one of the first 8. So I took my oath of office on February 4th of 2021. And we did not have our first meeting until later that month. Of course, we had the winter freeze. There were some delays. And then, as we've already noted, the first 8 commissioners had a really difficult task of choosing the additional 6. So I don't believe that we ended up becoming a full commission that started the work until about May. And then what the city charter states is that we have to adopt a final plan by November 1st, 2021. So between May and November of this year is when most of our work is completed. We are currently in the midst of public forums, and we are required to have one of these forums in each of the 10 city council districts. So that's the first stage. And then there are multiple stages after that.
So after we have heard from the public in each of the 10 districts, we will go to the drawing board. Each commissioner will have a chance to offer their input and integrate public comment in that with our mapping expert, George Corbel, who will draw the preliminary maps. And then we will take those preliminary maps to the public in each Travis County precinct. There's a possibility some of that might have to be virtual given stage 5 of the pandemic where we are right now. But we will definitely take comment from the public on the preliminary maps for at least 14 days before we go back to the drawing board and take all of those comments into consideration into the final maps. And then the final maps will be presented to the public as well. The city charter writes that in as a minimum of a meeting north of the river and south of the river, and we'll take comment for at least 5 days then before adopting the final maps on November 1st of this year.
Do the district boundaries have to respect the precinct boundaries? I mean, can you split a precinct?
Are you referring to Travis County precincts or election precincts?
Election precincts.
There are many election precincts, and in several cases, last time around, they were split between city council districts. And I think even in one case, split three ways with city council districts. And we want to do our best to minimize that. And it largely comes down to the residents who live in that city council district and in that precinct. We don't want them to be confused about who is representing them and the fact that their neighbor across the street might have a different representative than they do, even when they're in the same election precinct. So it's not impossible to avoid, but we can do as much as we can to mitigate that, including waiting for Travis County to come back with their updated election precincts in late November. And then even after we have adopted our final maps on November 1st, that we might go back and clean up the lines a little bit to better accommodate those election precincts down the road.
So I'm hearing two constraints so far. One is the population. They've got to be about 99,000 or so. The second was essentially neighborhoods. You're trying not to break up neighborhoods. What other goals are there that guide you in your determination of the district boundaries?
We have all of this written pretty explicitly in the city charter and in an order of priority. So at the top, we want to make sure that the districts are equal in population. So we want to be as close to 0% deviation as possible in the variance there between districts. However, there is flexibility, and that percentage is up to the commission and our council and our mapping expert to determine that percentage. Beyond that, of course, we're working under the guidelines of the Voting Rights Act. We want to maintain our opportunity district, and if the census data allows, we might have an additional opportunity district. And these are for Black and Hispanic Americans to make sure that they have the ability to elect a representative of their choice.
I will also just add here that according to the criteria of our charter, that these districts be geographically contiguous and that they are using identifiable boundaries. So if someone were looking at this map, let's say for the first time, they would get an understanding just visually of why the lines were drawn the way they were.
Since you've already had several community meetings, what are some of the concerns you've been hearing from the public?
A couple of the concerns that stand out to me the most are regarding the November 1st deadline, but I can assure you that our mapping expert who's been doing this for 50 years, his entire career, he is very confident that he can get those maps drawn in time for all the public comment that we'll need to produce the final maps by November 1st.
So we've heard disbelief that we could do all this work before that November 1st deadline, especially since we go off of 2020 census data. That's a big part of our work. We won't even have that till, I believe, August 16th. Between that date when we receive the data and November 1st is when a lot of our work is going to be done. And that kind of ties into another struggle for these forms with even just something as simple as promoting and advertising them. We are in the middle of a pandemic. It's really caused some issues in getting that public input. So we are doing our best to do both in-person and virtual forums. We were only required to have 10 public forums, but given the nature of the pandemic, went ahead and did two additional forums. So a total of 12. And those additional two are going to be completely virtual, citywide focused, and those will be on Saturday, August 21st and Friday, August 27th. I will say, please, if you are able to join us for one of our public forums, we want to hear from the residents of Austin about why redistricting matters to them. We really value the input, and it's going a long way in our decision-making.
So what does success look like for this commission?
First and foremost, I think success is greater representation for Austinites from all backgrounds. We want to make it easier for Austinites to know that they and their neighbors are all within the same city council district, same election precinct, even school board districts to the extent possible. I think it can be really disorienting to find out that the people who live across the street from you don't share your representative. And for the commission itself, I think success is producing and adopting the final map by our deadline, as well as creating opportunity districts for the city based on our demographic and geographic diversity. If we can accomplish all of those goals by our deadline, I call that a win.
where can people find out more information about being a part of this process?
We have a website, redistrictatx.org. People can reach us on Speak Up Austin. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Also, if you go on the city website, you can find all of our agendas for our meetings, including our Wednesday meetings at 6 p.m., where anyone from the public is welcome to come and communicate with the commissioners if they sign up in advance. Also, there are map worksheets that are specific to a certain district that we have at all of the in-person forums. And you can actually point on that map places of interest that matter to you. And then you can submit that map to icrc.commissioners@austintexas.gov so we can see that input through an interactive format.
Well, thank you for being on with us.
Thank you all for having us today.
Thank you so much, Bob. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Have a good evening, everyone, and stay safe. The vaccines work.